Isabel Fraser with Secret Lives. Many of us have secrets from our work colleagues, but my guest today, Dr. Rufus May, trained and qualified as a clinical psychologist before revealing to his colleagues that he himself had been diagnosed as schizophrenic. Rufus, if we start at this very significant point in your life, what do you think is the lead up to you becoming diagnosed with schizophrenia?
Well, actually, when I was 11, so some years before, my mother had a brain hemorrhage and was disabled physically and mentally, and eventually made a very good recovery, but it was quite an unsettling time. And after that, there was a tension between myself and her, and we did argue a lot and didn't see eye to eye over lots of things. And I gradually became more and more avoidant of responsibility and engaging in more hedonistic activities, not doing homework, hanging out on street corners, trying drugs, things like that. So my teenage years were fairly rebellious, and then I tried to pick my life up. I had a few periods of depression where I felt very guilty about my life and that I wasn't really going anywhere. And I managed to find a girlfriend who's quite trendy, and things seemed to be going better for me. And I tried to get into the advertising world. But then my girlfriend left me, and I found that quite difficult. And I was unable to get into the advertising world. I ended up getting a job as a trainee draftsman, which I thought would use my drawing skills and my creativity, but it was actually a very dull, boring job. The most exciting part of the day was making the tea.
What do you think triggered this for you? Was it your mother's illness, or was there something else happening that you might not have been aware of at the time?
I think I was just 18, and I was pretty lonely. I felt cut out of my girlfriend's sort of trendy social scene, and I was trying to avoid friends that I'd hung out with before because I was trying not to smoke dope. So I think it was a number of things. It was an identity kind of problem. I didn't know who I wanted to be. I felt like my life was looking like a very dull career ahead of me. And I think I sort of had this ability to escape into a alternative reality, if you like, a fantasy world, rather than get depressed. I started to think, well, what if I can develop a special relationship with God? And then it moved on from there. When I started looking into the Bible for messages for me, it made me feel special and that I had a mission. And then I wondered what that mission might be.
And sorry, I just wondered how much of your life then this alternative world became, and how attached to reality at this point you actually were, however you seek to define reality. How did this alternative life actually develop, and how powerful did it become? How dominant did it become in your day-to-day life?
I think it happened fairly quickly. I started to play with ideas about maybe my workplace wasn't what it appeared to be. Maybe it was a sort of spy centre. There was a front for a spy agency, but when I was asked to deliver packages, maybe there were secret parcels that I was delivering, but people couldn't tell me because it was also top secret, so it was up to me to decipher the codes around me. So I started to look out for special messages, and the more I looked out for special messages, the more I seemed to find them. In the Bible it says, "Seek and thou shalt find," and I think that's quite true.
Was this something that seemed perfectly rational and logical to you and perfectly reasonable, and therefore you interacted in a reasonable way with your colleagues, or did you start to behave in ways which suggested that you were possibly having problems at that stage?
I think I held it together fairly well, but as these ideas became more captivating, I started to sleep less and get quite excited about them. But I also started to wonder whether I was under surveillance. I felt like my room might be being bugged. So that actually led me to being pretty anxious. And I did start to speak to people about some of my beliefs. So I asked my neighbours, who were worked in a recording studio to look at my hi-fi to see if he thought it was bugged. And people didn't quite know how to react around me. I think they tended to just avoid me, really, I think. And I was starting to divide up my friends. Some I thought were communists because they were very sharing, but they weren't as creative. And then my more capitalist friends were more selfish, but they seemed a bit more creative and cool. So I liked both sides, and I was trying to work out which side I was on.
So it becomes a very complicated secret life with all these kind of layers. It's not straightforward, as it were. You get deeper and deeper into it, obviously.
That's right. I decided to have a party where I'd invite both sides to and try and help them make peace through music. So it's very symbolic, really, of I guess, identity problems we might all have or think about, but it was perhaps a bit more intense.
Presumably, it sounds like it's tipping into something very, very distressing for you, this secret life. You're starting to think that you're constantly under surveillance.
And yes. And at first that was exciting, so when I was taking the dog out for a walk, I'd wear a cap and hold it, pull it right down over my eye so people wouldn't know who I was. And I thought people might be calling out messages to me. A doorman, as I walked through Soho, said Shula, and I thought that was some special code word that I needed to remember. But the ideas did get more sinister, and I felt like I was on TV sort of all the time, almost, in my bedroom. Felt like I was being watched, and as I said before, I thought my radio might be being bugged. And then the ideas got even more sinister, and I started to get chest pains, and I think that's because I wasn't sleeping and because I was getting more anxious about these ideas. But at the time I didn't interpret them as stress related. I thought that maybe it was a gadget that was inside my chest that maybe had been inserted there. I started to hypothesize that my girlfriend had been on the opposing side of the spy game that I was involved in, and that she might have had it inserted at some point. Or even I had this idea, she used to make really nice sandwiches with avocado and cheese and mayonnaise, and I wondered if somehow something had been inserted in the sandwich. So I remember thinking that. But it became quite a frightening idea, yeah, that there was this gadget lodged in my chest that could be used to control me, and if I started to sort of step out of line, they could turn up the frequency and give me chest pains, ultimately terminate me.
Did you think at any point, I really need to get help here? Or were you so caught up in this secret life, this other world?
There was a part of me that did think, I'm exhausted. You know, this isn't working for me, being a spy. You know, I need time out.
So that was your reality, being a spy, as opposed to your reality of being a young man who's conscious that his mental health is deteriorating.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I didn't think that at all.
So it's when do you get to the point where you actually get some help?
Well, I went to my GP and told her about my beliefs about my chest. And she wasn't able to sort of offer an alternative explanation, which would have been helpful. I probably wouldn't have believed it was stress-related, but I could have held it there as an alternative theory. But instead she said I need to see a specialist. So I thought she meant a chest specialist, but it turned out to be a psychiatrist. And after a couple of interviews with psychiatrists, I was admitted to Hackney Hospital in London. And they fairly quickly made a diagnosis of schizophrenia. I think one of the reasons they jumped to that conclusion was there's a history of mental illness in my family. So it was assumed I had this genetic illness.
Did you think, I've just been completely overwhelmed by this, I have no control about what's happening here, or what were your thoughts at that time?
Well, I thought that the hospital wards must be a place for burnt-out spies. And anyway, as far as I was concerned, nothing was as it appeared, so that I was always trying to read between the lines as to what was really going on. So I thought that hospital was a place for burnt-out spies, and lots of people were there like me trying to recover from unsuccessful espionage.
So are you there voluntarily, Rufus, and you're taking medication voluntarily, or how is this working in practice?
I was there voluntarily, but if I tried to leave, they could make me stay, so it didn't feel voluntary. and I was eventually sectioned because I did try to leave.
And you were being medicated at the time?
Yes, and after a while I found the medication really unhelpful because it made me physically weak, unable to think straight, so I started to slip the tablets under my tongue.
And then you were forcibly medicated after
when they
that.
Found out about that, yeah, I was forcibly medicated, yeah, which I found sort of very degrading and frightening.
When you look back, do you have a sense of how you would have looked and how you would have behaved and how you would have seemed to others at that time?
I mean, when I first went into hospital, I felt like Jack Nicholson in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And I went around trying to be quite sociable with everyone and trying to make the best of what seemed a pretty grim place.
But were you frightened?
Yeah. Increasingly, you know, when I found out that some of the other patients seemed quite dangerous, not all, but one or two, you know, had problems with anger and stuff. So I started to try and pretend to be more dangerous than I was, and I developed a manic laugh, which I kind of copied from a couple of other patients, and a kind of bravado.
Did you ever worry that you would not get out?
I worried that I'd never get off the medication because I was being told I'd have to take it for the rest of my life, and I thought I just needed something to help me sleep, but I didn't want to take something permanently. I just felt that it completely deadened me. I thought it made sense for me to try and talk about my experiences, but my parents were told that talking therapy made people worse with diagnosis of schizophrenia, so that wasn't available to me.
But if you do finally get to a point in this treatment program, if that's how we should describe it, when you're finally discharged and you're being treated as an outpatient, how does your life develop after that?
Well, I actually had 3 admissions. And after the 3rd admission, I managed to get a job against doctor's advice. I managed to get a job in a cemetery, Highgate Cemetery, guarding Karl Marx. But actually, it was a very therapeutic activity because I was walking around in very wooded, ancient sort of burial ground and had to be very aware of the present moment. I couldn't think about the past or the future or what if kind of thoughts and face my fears. And I think it was actually a brilliant thing to do as part of recovery. Contrary to what doctors were saying, which was I needed rest, I needed to accept that I had this long-term mental illness, I had this blueprint from my mother's rehabilitation that what you need is to be very determined to improve your life and other people supporting you. I knew that I picked up a lot of bad habits, like the manic laugh in hospital, that made me seem really strange. I knew I had to unlearn some of those. They'd kept me safe in hospital, but they weren't going to do me any favours in the community. So I really sought out different places where people would accept me, not judge me, and try to focus on rebuilding my life. So I wrote to my doctor asking to be taken off the medication, and they didn't agree. So I eventually decided to come off on my own. And I'd already failed on 2 occasions to come off medication and ended up quite high because there's a kind of withdrawal effect of coming off medication where your brain's kind of trying to rebalance itself and is actually quite overactive. So I had to get through that period. But by this time I'd left home and I was living in a more slightly more liberal environment with friends. And I was able to go out for walks late at night and people didn't catastrophize it as a relapse of the illness. So I got through that sort of hyperactive stage without it being rehospitalized. And eventually I decided that I actually wanted to go back into the psychiatric system, not as a revolving door patient, but as a professional, because not just the experience of the way I was treated, but how I saw other people treated. And I just felt there must be another way to approach severe states of distress and confusion. I knew that my experiences on some level made sense. They weren't just arbitrary neurons misfiring. they had a symbolism that was important to be listened to. I knew that they were meaningful, even though they led to bizarre behaviour. So I felt the same about other people. It must be the same with them. And so I was determined to train as a psychologist. So I finally found my mission. And my mission was to try and change society's approach to mental health, because I really thought we were doing a lot of people an injustice by just drugging them up and forcing them to take drugs and forcing them to accept that they had lifelong medical conditions. So I went from being a rebel without a clue to having a cause.
So we get to the stage where you are a qualified psychologist. You're taken on as a trainee by a London health trust, and yet you do not tell them about your past life, your secret life.
Well, I was still training, so I felt I really needed to prove myself. I read up as much as I could on other people who've had mental health problems, and in the literature, there was a manual called the Survivor Workers Manual, and it said, don't tell anyone until you're in a power position where you can defend yourself. So I wanted to prove myself as a competent practitioner. But unfortunately, I walked into a meeting, and there was, on the other side of the table, was a nurse sitting there who recognised me, but he couldn't place me because I was out of context. And he was saying, don't I know you from somewhere? And I was kind of grinning at him, saying, maybe. managed to talk to him afterwards, and he agreed to keep it confidential.
Well, so let's go back then, because in this situation where you're trying to establish yourself professionally, you have to keep your past life secret as well, you feel at that then. I mean, how much of a strain was that?
Yeah, it was a strain. You know, you felt that it had this secret bubbling away, and you really wanted to tell people. Like, I really wanted to sometimes tell patients who were saying, you don't know what it's like to be psychotic, or you don't know what it's like to be told by a doctor you're never going to recover. And part of me wanted to say, yes, I do, you know. And I wanted to sort of share some of the wisdom. I could hear things being misrepresented in college about schizophrenia. You know, the idea that it was just a biological disease you couldn't do much about except medicate. I really disagree with that, and think there's a lot you can do to actually turn the experiences into something transforming and healing. So I had a very different point of view, but I couldn't completely be upfront with the reasons why I had that point of view. So I'd look for documents that would support my beliefs.
But a year after qualifying, you felt you were in a position to actually explain your real past.
That's right. So I actually worked very hard on presenting myself as very sane and rational and almost to the extreme, you know, to be whiter than white sort of thing.
What sort of things do you have to do? Yeah, I'm just interested in what sort of things people have to do to make themselves look sane.
Well, you know, just talk in a very detached way about things and just sound very rational. Just not give away any emotion. But you end up talking a bit like a robot.
Which in itself might be a bit disturbing to people having a conversation with you.
Yeah, but people trust that in the mental health system. That's the strange thing, is that that's the norm. Professionals don't talk about their own feelings. It's really discouraged. So I got very good at being like that. And when I did finally come out, I had a psychoanalyst say to me, but you always seem so sane to me. And I think what I've been able to do in the ensuing 7 years, that I've been much more open, is just reclaim my own kind of creativity and uniqueness, rather than having to be very wooden.
Well, we are laughing about it, because it does seem, in one sense, completely preposterous that people aren't allowed to have a kind of vibrant personality, or people in that particular field start to get a bit jumpy around it. But you were able, as you say, at one point then, to say, after you were qualified, actually, this is my experience, this is who I am, and I think it would be helpful that you know this, that I have had this diagnosis in the past. But what was the reaction, first of all, of your colleagues?
Well, colleagues, it was mixed. Some were positive and supportive, and some were quite threatened by it and said they felt intimidated by me. And I tried to say, look, don't feel intimidated. It's just another knowledge source. It doesn't mean I'm going to say I know best and you know nothing, sort of thing. Just respect it. Don't fear it. And I think we, in our society, we fear madness, and we're primed to by the newspaper headlines. And so if somebody starts talking about those experiences, it does make them quite intimidating. And I really want us to unravel that and learn not to fear madness. It's like dreams. They're symbolic. The voices or the unusual beliefs people have, you can actually make sense of them. So, but my professional colleagues, I guess I got more into working in more collaborative ways with service users.
Yes, the patients. How did the patients react to this?
Well, the majority were very enthusiastic about it, and people shook my hand and were really pleased. One of them had made it to the other side, kind of thing. There was that sense. Yeah, it did have quite a dramatic effect.
Do you also obviously have an insight into treatment programs, which perhaps, in general terms, need reviewing and could be done better? What is your attitude now to the treatment programs on offer? I know that's a very general question, but in your specific experience, what would you like to see change?
Well, in a nutshell, I'd like us to get rid of diagnosis. But actually diagnosing people with terms like schizophrenia, even manic depression, or now they call it bipolar disorder, we tell young people they've got these conditions for the rest of their life. And I just think that's not on. I think we need to... People need frameworks to understand their mania or their depression or their altered states of reality or their voice hearing. Definitely, we need to give people frameworks, but they need to be individually tailored to that person. So fitting someone into a medical category does not help them. It might do initially provide some relief. So people think, oh, now they know what I've got. But it actually limits the person because it tells them that they're the victim of this active illness, and they're, all they can do is take medication and lower their expectations about what they can achieve. So it actually disempowers the person. And I believe we have to kind of rethink how we look at mental illness and take a much more holistic approach so that we see illness not as something we have to defeat or suppress permanently with medication, but something we need to understand that illness in a holistic model is a way of releasing toxins from the body or the mind. So we need to work with it and understand it. So the way I work, say, with people who hear voices, as I help them talk to their voices, I might, using chairs, also talk with their voices and try and, even the most angry, aggressive voices, help the person make peace with their voices and reclaim their sense of control over the situation. What we don't do at the moment, we don't do that work. We don't help people make peace with their voices. We still encourage that fear around voice hearing.
Can I ask you, if you now have a sense of control over, I don't know if you'd label it schizophrenia, but your condition?
I see myself as having made a recovery age 20, 2 years after those experiences. I would see myself as pretty healthy.
And do you think then that the way the whole collective, as it were, and the medical profession responds to psychiatric illnesses is driven by a basic fear about mental health?
Yes, yes. Most nurses and most psychiatrists are afraid to talk with people about the content of their voices. I use this as an example, but that's a terrible situation. We've still got this taboo about making sense of people's apparent madness. But like when you do sit down and make sense with people, it starts to... there's a meaning that you can decode. It's not always literal. It's like the language of dreams. It's metaphorical.
This may sound a ludicrous question to you because nobody would wish mental health problems on anybody if there were problems they couldn't cope with. But do you think... What sort of role do you think your earlier experiences have had in informing who you are now and how you work with your patients and how you choose to see your own condition?
Okay, for me, yeah, I think my breakdown did make me a stronger person. and it helped release something that was suppressed. It made me a nicer person as well, nicer to be around. In my case, it helps me with my work. It helps. I'm not afraid of other people's strange behaviour, so it makes me quite a good practitioner. I think we need to help other practitioners develop that sense of fearlessness, and then we can really connect with people and help them heal.
And do you feel quite strongly that it was exactly the right thing to do to explain about what had happened in your life and not keep it a secret anymore?
It's difficult to envisage living with that secret. I lived with it for about 10 years and it did create quite a lot of pressure for me. And I'm very glad that I don't have to keep that secret anymore.
Dr. Rufus May, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.